from coming into Dakota from Canada or across today's Minnesota. If trade between the British and the Sioux was prohibited for a few years, he wrote, "The Sioux will be made to feel their dependence on the will of our government for their supplies of merchandise, and in the course of 2 or 3 years, they may most probably be reduced to order without the necessity of bloodshed." Given what happened in Sioux-American relations over the following 71 years, that was a hopelessly optimistic prediction. Much of the report was a business prospectus, with the emphasis on the Indian as customer and supplier. In a separate section, written in Clark's hand but the product of both men's labor, entitled Estimate of the Eastern Indians, the captains described no fewer than 72 different tribes and bands, with at least some information on where they lived, how they lived, who they were at war with, their numbers, their dwellings, and more. Of course, the captains could only describe a few tribes from first-hand knowledge, but they made clear where their information was word of mouth. Those they knew, they did not hesitate to characterize, often in a heartfelt fashion. They wrote of their friends the Mandans, "These are the most friendly, well-disposed Indians inhabiting the Missouri. They are brave, humane, and hospitable." Of the Teton Sioux, the opposite. "These are the vilest miscreants of the savage race, and must ever remain the pirates of the Missouri, until such measures are pursued by our government as will make them feel a dependence on its will for their supply of merchandise." Of the tribes living along the route they intended to follow, they wrote of the mountain-dwelling Flatheads, "They are a timid, inoffensive, and defenseless people. They are said to possess an abundance of horses." Of the Shoshones, the captain's information indicated that they traded with the Spanish, who refused to give them firearms. Consequently, although the Shoshones were a very numerous and well-disposed people, "all the nations on the Missouris below make war on them and steal their horses." Of the Nez Perce, "Still less is known of these people or their country. The water courses on which they reside are supposed to be branches of the Columbia River." Along with the written report, the captain sent back to Jefferson 108 botanical specimens to add to the collections at the American Philosophical Society, all properly labeled as to where and when collected and described. The first was a species of cress taken at St. Louis, May 10, 1804. It is common in the open grounds on the Mississippi bottoms, appears in the uncultivated parts of the lots, gardens, and orchards. The seed come to maturity by the 10th of May in most instances. If medicinal properties were claimed for a plant, Lewis mentioned them. If the claim touched a common medical problem back in the States, Lewis emphasized it, none more so than a root known by the name of white wood of the prairie, which was said to be sovereign for the bite of a mad wolf or a mad dog, and for the bite of the rattlesnake. Rabies and snake bite were common dangers in the early 19th century, so a cure was such an exciting prospect that Lewis made the root of the white wood the subject of a separate letter to Jefferson, in which he detailed how to prepare it as a poultice, how to apply it, and so forth. He concluded, "I have sent herewith a few pounds of this root, in order that experiments may be made by some skillful person under the direction of the Philosophical Society of Philadelphia." It was probably the purple cone flower, which was widely used by the Indians as an antidote for snake bite. Jefferson sent the root along to a doctor to experiment with it. Lewis also sent to Jefferson 68 mineral specimens, all labeled as to where and when collected. He included such items as sand of the Missouri, 1 pint of Missouri water, pebbles common to the Missouri, lead ore, quartz, glauber salts, alum, pyrites, lime, lava and pumice stone, and fossils. The plants and minerals were part of a larger shipment to Jefferson that included skeletons of a male and female pronghorn, the horns of 2 mule deer, insects and mice, skins of various animals, including a marten and a white weasel that came from beyond the mountains via the trade route, and more. There were live animals, too, new to science. 4 magpies, a prairie dog, and a prairie grouse hen. Only 1 magpie and the prairie dog reached Jefferson alive. Included also in the shipment was Clark's map of the United States west of the Mississippi River. It was a masterpiece of the cartographer's art and an invaluable contribution to knowledge. From St. Louis to Fort Mandan, Clark got it exactly right along the Missouri. His map became a bit sketchier as it moved west, naturally, because his depictions of the various tributaries was based on hearsay, often from people who did not claim to be eyewitnesses but knew someone who had been there. Lewis explained Clark's method. He would compare one Indian's description with another's, questioning them separately and at different times, and questioning as many as possible. Only when there was agreement on placement, distance, mountain passes, and so forth, was the information put on Clark's map and into Lewis's report. For all their concern with getting the specimens ready for shipment and with making their report and the map as complete as possible, in the first 2 weeks of spring, what was uppermost in the captain's minds was what lay ahead. They pumped the Mandans, who never ventured very far west and thus could tell them little, and the Hidatsas, whose war parties ranged to the mountains and who thus could tell them a lot. From the Hidatsas, Lewis had learned the names of rivers coming into the Missouri and their connections with one another. He commented on his source, "I conceive the Hidatsas are entitled to some confidence." Lewis expected to find, at 117 miles upriver from Fort Mandan, the White Earth River coming in on the north side. The prospect excited him greatly, because if the White Earth came in from as far north as the Indians indicated, it would mean that the boundary between Canada and the United States might be moved north by as much as a full degree of latitude, something Jefferson very much hoped for. 3 miles above the mouth of the White Earth, the Indians told Lewis he would come to the greatest of all the tributaries of the Missouri, the Yellowstone. The Hidatsas said that the Yellowstone waters one of the fairest portions of Louisiana, a country not yet hunted, and abounding in animals of the fur kind. They thought the river navigable at all seasons of the year for boats and pirogues to the foot of the Rocky Mountains, near which place it is said to be not more than 20 miles distant from the Three Forks of the Missouri. The obvious importance of the Yellowstone led Lewis to recommend that the government build a trading post at the junction with the Missouri. It would afford to our citizens the benefit of a most lucrative fur trade and might be made to hold in check the views of the British Northwest Company, whose intention was to panoplize the Missouri River fur trade business. If this powerful and ambitious company are suffered uninterruptedly to prosecute their trade, Lewis warned, the British might someday use their influence with the natives to block all American navigation on the Missouri. Some 150 miles upstream from the mouth of the Yellowstone would come the river which scolds at all others, falling in on the north side. Then the Musselshell from the south. Another 120 miles and the expedition would be at the falls of the Missouri, described by the Indians as a most tremendous cataract. They state that the noise it makes can be heard at a great distance. They also state that there is a fine open plain on the north side of the falls, through which canoes and baggage may be readily transported. This portage, they assert, is not greater than a half a mile. Some 15 miles beyond the falls, the Medicine River would fall in on the north side. Another 60 miles, and the expedition would enter the first connected chain of the mountains. After another 75 miles, the Missouri would divide into three nearly equal branches at the place called Three Forks, where Sacagawea had been captured some 5 years earlier. The most northern of the three rivers is navigable to the foot of a chain of high mountains, being the ridge which divides the waters of the Atlantic from those of the Pacific Ocean. The Indians assert that they can pass in half a day from the foot of this mountain on its east side to a large river which washes its western base. How Jefferson must have loved reading that line. The singular objective of the expedition was about to be realized. The divide was as far as the Hidatsas ever ventured. Lewis noted that, "We have therefore been unable to acquire any information further west than the view from the top of these mountains." But what the Hidatsas said they saw from the top of the mountains was exactly what Lewis and Jefferson hoped for and expected. The Indians inform us that the country on the western side of this river consists of open and level plains like those they themselves inhabit. The Flathead and Shoshone tribes lived on a river in that country. Their principal food was fish. "This river we suppose to be the South Fork of the Columbia," Lewis wrote, "and the fish, the salmon, with which we are informed the Columbia River abounds. This river is said to be rapid, but as far as the Indian informants are acquainted with it, is not intercepted with shoals." What had been high expectations now soared, both at Fort Mandan and some months later in Washington, when the report arrived and Jefferson read it with what must have been the most intense satisfaction, feeling that, even as he was reading, the all-water route to the Pacific was being found and mapped. Along with the report, Lewis sent back to St. Louis various letters, dispatches, and copies of the drafts and chits he had signed, what he called my public accounts. In a covering letter to Jefferson dated April 7th, but almost certainly written the previous day, Lewis confessed to considerable embarrassment about those accounts. He had intended to put them in order and have them returned to St. Louis in the fall of 1804, but in the event it turned out that the provision pirogue and her crew could not have been dismissed without evidently, in my opinion, hazarding the fate of the enterprise in which I am engaged, and I therefore did not hesitate to prefer the censure that I may have incurred by the detention of these papers to that of risking in any degree the success of the expedition. Jefferson had instructed Lewis to be diligent about his accounts and to get his drafts back to the War Department with all possible speed. Lewis said his failure to do so had become a serious source of disquiet and anxiety, and the recollection of your particular charge to me on this subject has made it still more poignant. Clearly, as an Army officer, Lewis had made the correct decision, but as the President's protege, he felt terrible about it because he hated disappointing Jefferson. Yet, however bad he felt about it, Lewis's casualness with his accounts and the chits he had signed was becoming habitual. In the second half of his April 7th letter to Jefferson, Lewis told his commander-in-chief his plans. In the morning, he intended to send the keelboat and pirogues on their way. Accompanying Corporal Worthington would be four privates plus Newman and Reed, Mr. Gravelines acting as interpreter, and four Frenchmen. They were well armed and adequately supplied. "I have but little doubt but they will be fired on by the Sioux," Lewis wrote, "but they have pledged themselves to us that they will not yield while there is a man of them living." The expedition's six canoes and two pirogues were loaded, ready to go. They would shove off the instant Worthington turned the keelboat downstream. Lewis said he intended to leave the two pirogues at the Falls of the Missouri. On the far side of the falls, he intended to put his iron frame boat together and cover it with skins. Freed of the cumbersome keelboat, Lewis said he anticipated traveling at a rate of 20 to 25 miles per day until he reached the falls. After that, any calculation with respect to our daily progress can be little more than bare conjecture. But his hopes were high. The circumstance of the Snake Indians possessing large quantities of horses is much in our favor, as by means of horses the transportation of our baggage will be rendered easy and expeditious over land, from the Missouri to the Columbia River. Supplies were adequate, Lewis said, thanks to the skills of the hunters, whose efforts made it possible to live on a diet of meat, thus saving the parched corn, portable soup, flour, and salt pork for the mountains. He put in not a word about Mandan corn, a glaring omission that left Jefferson with the entirely wrong impression that it was possible for white men to winter on the plains without help from the Indians. Lewis did say that the Indians assured him the country ahead abounds with a vast quantity of game. Lewis predicted that the expedition would reach the Pacific Ocean that summer, then return as far as the head of the Missouri, or perhaps even as far as Fort Mandan, for the winter of 1805-6. He told Jefferson, "You may, therefore, expect me to meet you at Monticello in September 1806. Lewis's concluding paragraph must be the most optimistic report from the field from an Army officer about to set off on a great venture that any commander-in-chief ever received. "I can foresee no material or probable obstruction to our progress, and entertain, therefore, the most sanguine hopes of complete success. As to myself individually, I never enjoyed a more perfect state of good health than I have since we commenced our voyage. My inestimable friend and companion, Captain Clark, has also enjoyed good health generally. At this moment, every individual of the party are in good health and excellent spirits, zealously attached to the enterprise and anxious to proceed. Not a whisper of discontent or murmur is to be heard among them, but all in unison act with the most perfect harmony. With such men, I have everything to hope and but little to fear." Chapter 18. From Fort Mandan to Marias River, April 7th to June 2nd, 1805. In the morning and early part of the afternoon of April 7th, 1805, Lewis was busy overseeing the last-minute wrapping of packages and their placement into the canoes that would head upriver to the mountains, or into the keelboat that was going downstream to St. Louis. He checked weapons, powder, food and medical stocks, trade goods, and implements. He gave last-minute instructions to Corporal Richard Worthington in command of the keelboat, mainly to be on full alert in Sioux territory, to be prepared to shoot his way through the Sioux, and to make sure the plants, animals, and artifacts he had selected, and the letters, journals, and reports he and Clark had created, got through to President Jefferson. At 4 o'clock p.m., the boats, pirogues, canoes, and crews were ready to shove off. The men of the permanent expedition called out goodbye, good luck, and Godspeed to the crew of the keelboat, then pushed their 6 small canoes and 2 larger pirogues, all heavily laden, into the current. They climbed in, took up their paddles, and began pulling upstream. They quickly got into their stroke, all the blades on the 6-man pirogues dipping into the Missouri in unison on both sides of the vessels as the men at the helm turned the craft upstream. How many strokes and how much poling and pulling of the vessels remained before they reached the source of the Missouri, no man knew. But they all figured it would be a lot. Lewis watched them go. For the past several weeks, he had been so busy writing he had taken no exercise. Feeling the want of it, and perhaps wanting to be alone on the occasion, he had decided to walk on shore that afternoon. He went up the north bank of the river some 6 miles to the upper Mandan village, where he called on Chief Black Cat. When he found the chief not at home, he returned 2 miles downstream, where he joined Clark and the party. Lewis took an early supper and went to bed. His bed was a buffalo skin and a blanket placed inside a buffalo skin teepee, apparently put up and taken down and packed the next morning by Sacagawea, perhaps with some help from York. The men slept in the open. Joining Lewis in his lodge were Clark, Charbonneau, Driard, Sacagawea, and her baby. Putting her in the tent, surrounded by the 2 captains, the hunter and interpreter, her husband and her son, removed temptation for the men. This sleeping arrangement persisted until Sacagawea and Charbonneau returned to the Mandan villages. It worked. There is not the slightest hint in the journals that having a young woman among those healthy, hardy soldiers ever caused a problem. That night, or shortly thereafter, Lewis wrote his first journal entry since February 13th. That entry is justly famous and deserves to be quoted at some length. Our vessels consisted of 6 small canoes and 2 large pirogues. This little fleet, although not quite so respectable as those of Columbus or Captain Cook, were still viewed by us with as much pleasure as those deservedly famed adventurers ever beheld theirs, and I dare say with quite as much anxiety for their safety and preservation. We were now about to penetrate a country at least 2,000 miles in width, on which the foot of civilized man had never trodden. The good or evil it had in store for us was for experiment yet to determine, and these little vessels contained every article by which we were to expect to subsist or defend ourselves. However, as this the state of mind in which we are generally gives the coloring to events, when the imagination is suffered to wander into futurity, the picture which now presented itself to me was a most pleasing one. Entertaining as I do the most confident hope of succeeding in a voyage which had formed a darling project of mine for the last 10 years, I could but esteem this moment of my departure as among the most happy of my life. In the morning, Lewis again walked on shore. He came to the Mandan village after 2 miles, and there paid a farewell visit to Black Cat. They smoked a pipe together. At noon, he descended to the river, where he had to wait for the party to come up since one of the canoes had filled with water. The men unloaded the craft and spread the contents to dry in the sun. That task completed, they made a few more miles in the late afternoon. In the evening, a Mandan man came up, bringing with him a woman who was extremely solicitous to accompany one of the men of our party. This, however, we positively refused to permit. Lewis refused for an obvious reason, not because a woman would be an extra mouth to feed, but rather because an unattached woman would be a source of jealousy and disruption. Sacagawea was already showing that she could make a contribution. Lewis noted on April 9th that, "When we halted for dinner, the squaw busied herself in searching for the wild artichokes which the mice collect and deposit in large hordes. This operation she performed by penetrating the earth with a sharp stick. Her labor soon proved successful, and she procured a good quantity of these roots." They were Jerusalem artichokes. The roots were welcome because the hunters were unable to kill anything. Hidatsa braves had frightened the game out of the river valley within 2 or 3 days' ride of the villages, reducing the party to subsisting on parched corn and jerky. But the Indians had assured Lewis that game would be plentiful once the expedition got beyond the range of the hunting parties, and meanwhile the little fleet was making excellent progress. On April 9th, it covered 23.5 miles, which was what Lewis hoped to make as an average, and was about double the distance the expedition had averaged on the river below the Mandans, when it had been encumbered by the clumsy, slow-moving keelboat. The white pirogue was the flagship of the fleet. Slightly smaller than the red, the white pirogue was more stable, so it carried the astronomical instruments, the medicines, the best trade goods, the captain's writing desks, their journals and field notes, and several casks of gunpowder. It was propelled by 6 paddlers, including the 3 non-swimmers among the privates, who were on board for safety's sake. Sacagawea and her baby, riding all bundled up on her back in his cradle board, joined Charbonneau, Driard, and the 2 captains. Most of the time, one or the other of the captains walked on shore. Their rule was that one of them should always be with the fleet. The flat-bottomed pirogues were